equal time. Another viewpoint, other considerations. Equal time.
Your host for Equal Time Radio on Mondays. My theme, as usual, is energy, food, and the local economy at the end of the age of oil. I've got a blog about similar topics. It's called Relocalizing Vermont. I'm one of the many bloggers at the Vermont Commons website, vtcommons.org/blog. Put up a couple new posts over the weekend. How your U.S. tax dollars were used to give a Pulteney man $3,500 to go shopping for a pickup truck that gets 18 miles per gallon. That's stimulus money at work for you. Also, why an organization of cops say that they want to see all drugs legalized. That's vtcommons.org/blog. Also, the audio from this and Travin's radio shows on Tuesdays on Equal Time are available for downloading at equaltimeradio.com. Usually by the end of the day on Tuesday, I get up Monday's show. And this Monday's show is a great show coming up. We're going to welcome back New York State author and homesteader Sharon Astick. We've talked with her before about her previous book, Depletion and Abundance. And today we're going to talk about her new book, which is A Nation of Farmers, Defeating the Food Crisis on American Soil. Astick sees the energy shortages of peak oil hitting us and our food system starting right about now. And she's arguing that U.S. food security depends on 100 million of us starting to farm again in the near future. So we'll be talking to her about that and many other things. And she'll stay on for the entire hour so that she can also talk with us with four Vermonters who will say what Vermont is doing to move us toward much stronger local food systems. We'll be talking with Carl Russell. He's a farmer in Bethel, Vermont. Roger Albee. He's the Secretary of Agriculture. Chris Bray. He's a state representative on the House Agriculture Committee. And finally, Enid Wanacott, director of Vermont's chapter of NOFA, the Northeast Organic Farming Association. So Sharon Astick, author of A Nation of Farmers, welcome back to Equal Time.
Thanks so much for having me.
So great to hear you again, and great that you can make time for us amongst the goats, gists, garlic, and chaos in your life this week.
Yeah, it's been a busy summer here. So, you know, all creatures great and small are demanding attention.
And for those of you who aren't familiar with all of Sharon's work, she writes extensively on a blog in addition to the books she works on and the homesteading she does. And the blog is SharonAstick.com. That's Sharon, S-H-A-R-O-N, and then Astick, A-S-T-Y-K.com. And Goats, Guests, Garlic, and Chaos was a headline for her blog post about what the last week has been like for her. And I'm going to have a link to this blog site, also the blog site, or the site promoting A Nation of Farmers on the Equal Time Radio website. So look for that. So Sharon, you co-authored A Nation of Farmers with Aaron Newtons. Could you tell us how this collaboration came about and why you two decided to work on the book together?
Well, Aaron interviewed me at Community Solutions Conference on Peak Oil in 2006, and he was there as a journalist, and I was there as a speaker, and we both separately had sort of had this vision of, you know, we really need to deal with this agricultural crisis. We need to get the fossil fuels out of agriculture. Lots of people seem to already have made that step, but those fossil fuels have to be replaced by something, and one of the things they're going to be replaced by is human beings paying attention to their food systems and getting involved in that. And that part of the equation really hadn't been analyzed. So we had this common interest, and Aaron was a landscape architect trying to get people to sort of infill agricultural land into suburban developments, and I was raising food and writing about it, and we decided this is a good time for us to bring our talents together because there's so much need right now.
And you know, I recognize some of the text in this book when I read it. So you used your blog as sort of a rough draft for some of it, correct?
I do. It's wonderful because I have this huge body of readers who will say exactly what they think of my writing, and some of it not always good, but it's always productive and intellectually stimulating, and often things end up being much better because I've run this through, you know, this sort of public forum, which is really just a wonderful thing.
So the subtitle of your book, A Nation of Farmers, is Defeating the Food Crisis on American Soil. So what food crisis?
Well, I mean, that's the thing. when we started putting the book to press last year, nobody would have said, what food crisis? You know, last year, of course, the world food crisis was all over the papers. But in the meantime, the economic crisis is, of course, pushed off the stage, the fact that more than 100 million people who were not hungry before have become gone from sort of getting barely enough to eat to starving in the last year. And there are now more than 1 billion people who chronically suffer hunger. That's the largest number there has ever been. And really, this has all happened in the last couple of years. Meanwhile, hunger in the United States has grown dramatically. It's not something we think about. I mean, we sort of, you know that in the abstract, yes, people are hungry, but we don't sort of think about it. But New York City has seen demand for food pantries and soup kitchens double. In the last 2 years, we've gone from 1 out of every 13 people getting food stamps to 1 out of every 9. And in states like Michigan and in Washington, D.C., it's 1 out of every 6 people, households, uses food stamps. When you get to that level of food stamp usage, we're not really talking about a sort of safety net program. We're talking more about a basic subsidy on food, which is saying, look, Americans can't afford their grocery bills anymore because of all the other high costs they're dealing with. So we're living in a food crisis, but we've sort of normalized it. We sort of forgot it was there. It's a little strange.
And that subsidy on food that you mentioned, that's taking place at the sort of the consumer end, but there's also a lot of subsidies at the producer end that makes the food at the consumer end, some of it at least, a lot cheaper than it otherwise would be.
We spend less on food than any people in the world, and yet something like 1 out of every 8 American households can't fully afford the food it needs to eat, which makes for a very, very strange and troubling thing. And so much of this is paid for by agricultural subsidies, by subsidies at the food stamp end. Don't mistake me, I'm not in any way opposed to food stamps. I actually think they're a pretty good program as government programs go. But I do think it's really important that we recognize the fact that we have the cheapest food in the world and we can't afford it.
And how does, I mean, we've walked through this on this show a number of times before. I think you probably even helped us with it. But one more time, how does energy scarcity relate to this food crisis?
Well, somewhere between, about 18% of our energy is used at some point in the food system. It's a really high percentage. And almost, we all know the statistic, probably have heard it to death, about there being 10 calories of oil for every calorie we put into our mouths. So we have this enormous amount of fossil fuel used at just about every stage in the food system. And it really goes from, the planting stage, where we're using these high-powered industrial tractors. And people can sort of, I think, envision that. When they think oil in the food system, they think tractors. But, of course, energy, fossil fuels in the food system actually appear in a whole host of ways, in the fertilizers we're using, in the pesticides we're using, in the shipping process, we've replaced human labor in many cases by using new, very technical equipment that costs hundreds of thousands of dollars to manufacture and to purchase. And then, of course, we also use those fossil fuels everywhere in our own process, from the refrigerated cases at the grocery store to our own fridges to our stoves at home. So we are utterly dependent on fossil fuels pretty much every time we take a bite of food.
And the connection last year between the spike in oil prices and the spike in food prices?
Absolutely direct connection for several reasons. One of them, of course, is that oil is so extensively used in agriculture. We found that last year farmers were having trouble affording fertilizer. There was a huge spike in fertilizer prices. They also had trouble affording other inputs and gas for their tractors. But the other, of course, direct connection is biofuels. We are putting an enormous amount of our grains in our gas tanks. And the reality is when cars and people compete for food, the people always lose. So the people who, it's one thing to see we've got hunger in the United States where we have the cheapest food in the world. More than 2 billion people in the world spend more than 50% of their income on food. And so when prices go up by 20, 30%, they find that they can no longer get enough food. So those biofuels, and the UN estimates that 40 to 60% of the price spike was related to our biofuel usage, and that, of course, is related to our energy depletion issues. We wouldn't be using these biofuels if we had all the fossil fuels we ever needed.
Well, you say that when cars compete with people for food, the people always lose. I think it's worth pointing out that the cars lose, too. I mean, I was surprised when I did a calculation several years ago as ethanol was really starting up the steep part of it, its ramping up phase, that if you'd taken the previous year's corn harvest and turned all of it into ethanol and ignored the energy that went into producing that ethanol, but just looked at the energy content of the ethanol, you'd have enough gasoline for about 12 or 13% of the U.S. usage that year.
Yeah. And it's, I mean, the reality is that biofuels can never, ever do what people want them to do. We're always, you know, just around the corner, and we're going to use all this, we're going to use these waste, you know, products that are lying around. Well, those waste products are provide fertility. They prevent soil erosion. Those waste problems are, say, corn stalks and things like that. Or we're going to use all that wood that's lying around on the ground of the forest. Well, that's what keeps the forest fertile. Biofuels are always a losing proposition, and unfortunately, they're always going to be a losing proposition, and they are most deeply a losing proposition for the world's poorest people, but they're also a losing proposition for every American. I mean, we have been seeing the economic costs. I mean, I wrote an article a while back called Peeling the Onion, where I argued that one of the reasons for the global economic slowdown was that most of the new consumers coming into the market, most of the people who are bringing new money into our economy, were those poorest people in the world who had gotten a little bit less poor in some places. You know, in China and Vietnam, they had new industry, and they were spending their money in ways that went into the pockets of large-scale corporations and circulated around. But when food prices spiked up, those people found themselves unable to pay school fees and buy Coca-Cola and send the, you know, and buy medicines. And that money that was going into the global economy started going only into a small number of food producers. So, I mean, there's a case to be made. I'd be happy to argue that someday with an economist, that we also hurt ourselves. I mean, we undermined our economic development in using biofuels and in pushing up the food prices the way we did.
Now, it's interesting. I'll just mention parenthetically, we've had David Bloom on this show. He's a permaculturalist who argues, who has an understanding of the needs of the soil to be replenished and what goes into farming. And he argues and has been arguing since the 1980s that the U.S. can produce enough ethanol to meet all of its current gasoline needs and export some with permaculture methods and do it in a sustainable way. But, you know, when you talk to them about how do you automate this, how do you get the big harvesters, threshers, and so on to be working on harvesting these mixed crops in the permaculture mix, then he says, well, you can't really do it. You need 20 or 25 or 30 million people involved in the farming to do it. And that brings us to 100 million farmers, which is the number you like to talk about.
Well, that's exactly it. I'm not claiming that there's no biofuels that could ever be done well. I just think under the current industrial model, they're a losing proposition, and that's a good point. And yeah, I mean, I think that's the reality. It's really fascinating. When Cuba experienced a 20% drop in its oil inputs, all your listeners probably know the story of Cuba about how, you know, Cuba underwent some severe hunger. The average Cuban lost 20 pounds. You know, the industrial food system really fell apart with this fairly comparatively small oil shock. I mean, it really
this was in the 1990s after the Soviet Union collapsed.
Yes, and what was fascinating was when they sort of began to remediate this by developing local agriculture and feeding people with these farms, what they found was it was perfectly viable to replace people in the system with small-scale farmers. The small farms, you know, all right, you take the fossil fuels out and you put in a guy with an ox, and, you know, things work pretty well. The large-scale 1,000-acre farms, and Cuba was actually a very, very industrialized agriculture nation. I mean, we sort of think of Cuba, you know, from sort of an American perspective as probably less industrialized than us, but their agriculture was actually probably at least as industrialized as we were. And they... you know, they found that you just couldn't run these enormous farms without fossil fuels. The same thing is true in Russia when the Soviet Union collapsed and oil prices, you know, oil just wasn't available. People couldn't run these large-scale farms without fossil fuels. And I think that's a useful lesson for us because we know that the scale of agriculture that we can manage in even a low fossil fuel usage, even in a level that, for example, would allow us to cut our carbon emissions to a level that would prevent us crossing those dangerous tipping points, it's not possible to have farms of 10,000 acres or even 1,000 acres. We have to get smaller, and that means more farmers. It means more people growing food on smaller plots of land.
Does it mean rototillers powered by ethanol or gasoline? Does it mean people with hoes, people with draft animals?
Yes, all of the above, I think. Mm. I mean, it's not a case, I mean, we're sort of figuring out now what level of fossil fuel usage both we're going to be able to have in the coming decades, but also what level we could support and keep the world from, you know, heating up beyond our capacity to manage here. And that level is quite low. So, yes, I think fossil fuels, some fossil fuels or, you know, biofuels will be used for tractors. You know, there's a guy named Bob Waldrop who's done a great job demonstrating that basically U.S. oil production could fuel U.S. agriculture for, like, the next 50 years if you were simply to allocate the resources only to that. I mean, we do have some oil.
We are the third largest producer of oil in the world. A lot of people don't realize that. But Saudi Arabia is first, Russia is second, and the U.S. is third. We're also the biggest importer of oil in the world, and we import two-thirds of the oil we use. So we have lots of opportunities to achieve efficiencies in oil use.
Exactly. I mean, we all talk about energy independence. Well, we could achieve energy independence tomorrow if we were willing to use, you know, one-eighth of our current fossil fuels. So, you know, it's one of those things that's, you know, sort of troubling. I don't mean to make that sound as easy as I do, but I think it's one of those things where certainly we have some fossil fuels to use in agriculture, and my suggestion is not, oh, everybody goes back to their hoes for the rest of their lives. But I think for home gardens, you know, victory garden style solutions, the rototiller, you know, and the, you know, fossil fuel tractor really is overkill. Or maybe you need one for neighborhood and then people, you know, people share it. But the idea that everybody needs their own personal tiller or their own personal, you know, fossil fuel tools here is probably wrong. And it's probably economically not viable for people who are really struggling economically. And that's a lot of us.
One person I was talking to about peak oil suggested that one of the preparations that Vermont could make is by stockpiling rototillers and having them available on a community basis around various neighborhoods.
Yeah, absolutely. Or even encouraging people, for example, to use their newspapers and the cardboard that they probably get and recycle every day to simply mulch over the places they're going to want to garden next spring and let that rot down. It'll cover up the weeds. You won't have the burst of weeds you get when you till. So you can. There's a lot that could be done with the resources we have.
Mm. And if you're just tuning in, we're talking with Sharon Astick. She is a co-author of A Nation of Farmers, Defeating the Food Crisis on American Soil. And before we take a break, I want to get you to explain what the big lie is.
The big lie is the thing that keeps us from moving forward. It's this idea, and I think a lot of us have it in our head, that says Americans will never. You know, and you can end that sentence however you want. We all say, okay, well, we're used to being comfortable, so you could never get 100 million Americans to grow gardens or to farm. Except that when you think about human history, when you think about American history, I have to imagine that everybody 2 years before the American Revolution said, you could never break away from Britain. They're simply too powerful. Or you could imagine that, for example, you know, before, you know, I mean, certainly I remember going back into the 80s and 90s, people saying, well, you'll never have people allowing gay people to get married. You'll never, for example, get black and white people sitting at the same lunch counter.
Or get smokers to smoke outside.
Yeah, exactly. We constantly look at changes that need to happen and say that's just completely impossible, and it is.
Hello? Sharon? I thought that was a dramatic pause, but it went on a little bit too long. So we're going to work on getting Sharon Astick right back. And then we're going to have a lot of good callers from Vermont. We're going to have Carl Russell. He's a farmer from Bethel. Roger Albee, the Secretary of Agriculture. Chris Bray. He's a representative in the House Agriculture Committee. And finally, Enid Wanacott, she is the Director of NOFA, will be talking with Sharon about her book. So the book is A Nation of Farmers, Defeating the Food Crisis on American Soil. And we're going to be right back after this. Good afternoon. Welcome back to Equal Time. I'm Carl Ettenier, and we've been talking with Sharon Astick. She is a co-author of A Nation of Farmers, Defeating the Food Crisis on American Soil. And she broke off in the middle of a sentence, not because she got distracted, we think, but because something happened with the phone lines. And we've been getting an all circuits are busy now signal trying to call her back. Fortunately, we have a couple guests on the line who I'd lined up to talk about Sharon Astick's agenda and what Vermont is doing to move in that direction. First off, from Earthwise Farm and Forestry in Bethel, we have an actual Vermont farmer, Carl Russell. Carl, welcome back to Equal Time.
Hi, Carl. Thanks for having me on.
So, A Nation of Farmers, Sharon Astick's book, is aimed primarily at people who aren't farming, urging them to get more involved with their local food system. And you are a farmer, and you're reaching out to other farmers, and I think to wannabes as well, to teach them animal-powered farming and things like, you know, how to slaughter chickens on the farm. So can you tell us about that and how it relates to Sharon's message?
Yeah, well, I read a couple of Sharon's, well, her first book and some of her blogs, and I really appreciate her perspective on things, and it resonates with me because it's been something that I've been working on since the mid-80s, and my wife Lisa McCrory and I are basically farming here in Bethel. We have a small-scale diversified farm. We have only draft animals for our motive power. We farm small-scale, a little bit of farmer's market and some woodland as well, and I never really, I mean, as much as it's nice that Sharon's taken a lot of time and she can really put out a call to people to try to say what we need to have 100 million farmers, you know, a lot of this stuff made sense to me a long time ago, but I never really went into it with an objective to turn people's heads. Although I've gotten a lot of those comments, like Sharon was saying, about you'll never be able to. But after 20-some-odd years of raising and slaughtering the animals that I eat exclusively, I've had people coming out of the woodwork wanting to spend time with me, wanting to have an opportunity to learn those skills. People come to me all the time wanting to spend time with me, working with my oxen and my horses. And, you know, Lisa and I are both board members for Rural Vermont, and yesterday Lisa had 12 people in our kitchen as a fundraiser for Rural Vermont, teaching them about making yogurt, butter, and ricotta cheese.
Hmm.
And yes, both wannabes and people who are, well, you know, I think that there's a fine line between being a wannabe and being a farmer. I think what is important about Sharon's conversation as well is that we recognize that farming and agriculture, the activities of cultivating land are the same. They're not restricted by scale, and I think it's very important that people who want to raise a few tomatoes in a flower box are recognizing their ambition to participate in their food system is just as valid as someone who wants to start to feed half of their village through a market garden.
And just to be clear, Carl Russell, that this farming and the use of your draft animals on other people's land for logging, that's how you make your living. This isn't a hobby, correct?
Right, yeah.
Very good. And Sharon Astick, I believe we have you back on the radio.
Yes, I'm delighted.
Yeah, well, welcome back. I think you heard some of what Carl Russell, a farmer down in Bethel, was saying. Do you have any comments?
Yeah, I did, and I mean, I think it's absolutely wonderful. I mean, I'm particularly thrilled to see people using draft animals again because I think they're so valuable and so wonderful. But I also, I mean, I agree with him completely about scale. I mean, it's really important to remember that in the United States, we have this idea that a farmer is a you know, a guy with a tractor and 3,000 acres in Iowa. But on a world scale, 85% of the world's farmers are small farmers. Most of them are farming less than 5 acres. Many of them are farming much, much less than 5 acres. And so it's important to remember that the line between farmer and gardener, I mean, we call it a nation of farmers, and I don't necessarily think everybody's going to go out and get 100 or 20 or even 2 acres. But the line between farming and gardening isn't, as Carl says, isn't always very clear.
Carl Russell?
Yeah, well, and you know, and that's what I try to emphasize with people is that, you know, in fact, the it's farming. I say farming is a bundle of activities related to land and animals, and the extent to which you spread that over area is a personal choice, and I think that it really comes down to, for me, just being my ambition was to be personally involved in my food. I feel well, when I was a child in Vermont, people raised their own animals and slaughtered them. They raised their own garden and put them away. They drove their truck to town once a week to get grain and some groceries. They shared their farm equipment. They built their houses. They were self-employed and had a lot of things that they could do themselves. And I, as I became a young man in my 20s and I saw the opportunity to get a credit card and blast off into this world of career, I realized, no, you know, this makes sense to actually stay on the land and to become involved in the aspects of my life that are important and have some control over them.
Very good. And we'll be talking with you in the coming months, Carl Russell, more in detail about how you use animals on your farm and the Animal Power Field Days, which you are once again putting together in October this year in Tunbridge.
Yeah, and Sharon might be interested in knowing about that, as well as other listeners, that this is our third annual Northeast Animal Power Field Days. It's a two-day trade fair and conference focusing primarily on the use of draft animals, but also secondarily and equally as importantly on the activities of land use and building community around agriculture and forestry.
And that website is northeastanimalpowerfielddays.com, I believe?
Animal Power Field Days, it's all spelled out, animalpowerfielddays.org.
Animalpowerfielddays.org.
Put out our program for this year.
And we'll have that on our website, equaltimeradio.com, as
great.
Well. Carl Russell, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you. Say hi to everybody else that's on.
Okay. And one of the other people who is on is Roger Albee. He's the Secretary of Agriculture for the great state of Vermont. Roger, welcome to Equal Time.
Oh, thank you, Carl. And I want to also talk about what Carl Russell said. If you haven't been to the Animal Power Field Days that Carl and Russell and their team put on, it's something you have to see. It does bring back the memories, certainly of my childhood, and I think Carl said it well, that there is a lot of what I'd call renaissance of local foods taking place that a lot of us grew up on. I think Carl's a lot younger than I am, but I certainly hark back to the days when we slaughtered our own animals and chickens and did the maple syrup in the spring and had the milk, and my mother had us make sure we got the cream off the top of the milk bottle for her to make whatever product she had to make, including whipped cream. So there is a renaissance, and scale is not important. We're seeing certainly a great deal of increased interest in buy local. The farmers market growth that is taking place is amazing. The people interested, I know last year the Anson Tebbets organized some canning workshops for people who wanted to learn how to can. The people who now are growing vegetables related to their housing projects, senior housing projects, are now talking about having gardens nearby. I know where my 93-year-old mother is. They have raised bed gardens nearby and are growing lettuce and tomatoes and other vegetables, and I see the seniors out there working on it daily.
So we're making an evolution here. What about Sharon's goal of 100 million farmers in the U.S. and Vermont? That translates into somewhat over 200,000 new farmers. Do you think that's a goal for Vermont?
Sharon also said it right, is that maybe the definition of farmers is not a definition that is realistic today. That people who, J. Carl, what you've done on the Capitol grounds with your team growing vegetables, that's wonderful, and yet it's feeding people, right?
Absolutely.
And I wouldn't necessarily say that we would call that a farmer's plot in the traditional sense of what people think of, but certainly it is a farmer's plot.
Very, very much so. Sharon Astick, your comments?
Well, I think a lot of the new farmers are going to be very small-scale farmers for two reasons. One, it's very hard to make a living as a farmer. We don't treat agriculture very well in this country, and it's very difficult for farmers to make a living. So a lot of, if we're going to start really evolving our local food systems, we're going to have a lot of people who are doing this on the side as a retirement income, or they're doing it for just their families to get them better food in gardens and small plots. I was in Chicago last week, and I met a woman who goes to the farmer's market every day, who's literally her entire farmer's market produce is on her balcony in her Chicago home.
Wow.
She has three beehives up there. And her beehives produce honey that she sells at the farmer's market. But literally, it has nothing to do with the ground at all. So it's surprising how much,
Sharon, even in New York City, people have been growing vegetables on their rooftops for some time.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, and the other reality of this is, of course, we need food most where people really live. And the more densely people live, the more desperately we need food there because of the transport and energy costs of bringing it in from far away.
Very much so. Roger Albee, Secretary of Agriculture, any final comments?
Well, I think what we're seeing taking place with the interest in local foods and what I say the renaissance of certainly my childhood is exciting, and I think it's a direction that I know in my conversations with some of the new people in USDA in Washington, it's a direction that they want to encourage as well.
Okay, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Roger Albee is Secretary of Agriculture for the great state of Vermont. And next we'll go to somebody else in the governmental connection to agriculture. Chris Bray is a representative, and he's on the House Agriculture Committee. Chris, welcome to Equal Time.
Hi, Carl. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
And hello, Sharon.
Hi.
And one of the accomplishments that, I don't know about you, but I'm proud, very proud of you accomplishing this last year, is getting the farm-to-plate bill through. Can you explain what it is and how it connects with Sharon's vision of stronger local food systems?
Sure, absolutely. The farm-to-plate bill has two goals. One is to grow our Vermont agricultural food economy. And secondly, to provide Vermonters with better access to more healthy local foods. It's really a response to a huge opportunity, and that is right now Vermonters import 97% of the food we eat. Even though we're a very agricultural state, a lot of what we're growing is, related to dairy, and we export 90% of the dairy products we make. So when we're buying in this 97%, we spend over $2 billion doing that. And the thing that got me started is the notion of, well, what would it look like if we had a 10% shift? If you take just 10% of the $2 billion we send out of state buying in our food and retained it, that's $200 million. And then there's always a multiplier effect for economic development work. Sometimes I call it the exaggerator effect, but the ag multiplier is usually somewhere from 2 to 7. So I picked a conservative 2, and if you take the $200 million multiplied by 2, now you're up to $400 million worth of economic activity. So that's based on some very initial work before the bill got going, even that made me feel as though there's a huge opportunity. Vermonters are very much interested, and why aren't we growing more of our own local food?
So what will be the outcome of this bill after all the processes have been gone through?
To get to the outcome, I think we'll have my guess about what it will look like over the next decade, because the time frame for this bill is a decade. It's just not like some sort of snap our fingers and we have something new, meaningful done. It starts with an inventory, looking at Vermont growers, processors, distributors, and markets. So who's already out there in the food marketplace? Then once it gets this inventory, it actually will be creating a map that will show where all these players are, and we'll be looking for doing a gap analysis. So where are there markets that aren't connecting with other markets? Where are there bottlenecks, things like that? Every one of those problem areas actually really represents an opportunity for someone, not the state, but it could be some new entity. It could be a co-op, could be a private company, could be an individual, to make that linkage and have that food start flowing. And then when you take all those opportunities and you prioritize them and you come up with a strategic plan. So the goal is the inventorying process is just beginning now. The goal is that by next summer we'll have this strategic plan, a statewide and even beyond our borders, to a regional strategic plan with a focus on Vermont for how we'll increase our local foods.
Very interesting. Sharon Astick, author of A Nation of Farmers. In your book, you talk about achieving 100 million farmers by people reaching out to each other, to their neighbors, and building local food systems with them. Here we have an effort by the state to bring people together. What are your comments on that?
I'm thrilled to see this sort of thing. I mean, I think that that's absolutely necessary. And there are so many places where very small investments of resources could connect people who really want good food with people who can provide it and who really need a better source of income than selling at sort of wholesale market prices that fluctuate. Because we've been driving farmers out of business, you know, when we can't afford to lose them. So I think these efforts to build and connect, you know, farmers with consumers are so important. I think it's wonderful.
Hmm. Chris Bray, representative from New Haven, any other comments?
Well, I think, you know, I'd be remiss if I didn't say that this has been a very collaborative effort to get to where we are. It started with Vermont Businesses for Social Responsibility organizing a series of conversations around the state that helped bring this need and opportunity into focus. Rural Vermont was a strong participant as we worked through the legislature. The co-sponsor was Representative Jason Lorber, and he's on economic development, and I'm on ag. So we had this unusual pairing of ag and economic development to work it through. Then, you know, we just talked with Secretary Roger Albee. He's actually on the advisory board to this. We've partnered with the Sustainable Ag Council. We've partnered with your next guest, Enid Wanicut of NOFA Vermont. So I think what gives me a lot of confidence about this is I clearly see the opportunity. The challenge is, you know, how do we move forward and make progress? And my confidence in the progress we're going to make is that we have so many good players involved who know the system from one end to the other.
Chris Bray, representative from New Haven, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
And now we're going to go to Woodbury, where Ray is called in from. Ray, hello.
Hey, how are you doing?
Good.
I'm stunned. I mean, I called in with a question, but I just listened to that representative talk, and I just heard more hogwash. Sounded to me like some slick flatlander talking to us, and he didn't say a word that was worth a darn. He had all this crap that he talked and nothing else.
What didn't you like about it, Ray?
The whole thing.
From bottom to top.
Bottom to top. It was just a bunch of words thrown together. Like a campaign speech.
Yep. What's your question, Ray?
Well, my question was actually for the Secretary of Agriculture. I'm curious to know why that milk is at its highest price and our farmers are at their lowest price ever.
I'm afraid we don't have him on the show anymore.
I know, but I called in to ask him. And then this guy was on. He's on the agricultural thing, but I'm sure I would have got a bunch of hogwash on that. But what this lady is trying to do is great. And she's right. We need everybody to turn into farmers. Instead of growing grass, grow vegetables. But it's hard today with all the people moving to Vermont. I remember in the 50s all the farms that were around, and then they passed the law about cement floors in all the barns. They didn't need them. And then they passed all the laws about homogenizing milk and pasteurizing milk cider, honey, and all it does is ruin the food.
Mm. That's a good point. Sharon Astick, what's your take on laws and present laws that interfere with people getting into farming?
Well, I think that we have a very over-legalized system. I feel like, you know, for example, with milk, there are real risks to drinking milk, you know, straight from the cow. However, you know, I believe that people should be able to bear those risks. They should understand them, and they should be able to decide, okay, there are some advantages as well. I'm going to choose to drink raw milk. But of course, you know, it's almost impossible for somebody to start up a dairy these days. You know, I have a friend who just started up a goat dairy, and, you know, it was close to $100,000 to get all the equipment, you know, together in order to do that in New York State. Most people can't do that. So, you know, I raise goats, but I'll never sell my milk because I can't afford the investment in equipment. And that's true in a whole host of ways. We have these systems that are designed for industrial agriculture. For example, you know, the reasons for we're treating milk the way we are is because what we're doing to milk is we're pumping it into bulk tanks. We're mixing often in large dairy farms in states that have that sort of thing. Then we're mixing milk from faraway places that aren't tested enough. And so, of course, we have to have these protections in place. On the other hand, when you've got somebody who has 6 cows and who tests their cows regularly and knows all their cows' names and watches them to make sure they're not sick, you're talking about a different animal. But the regulations across the board are for industrial producers. The industrial producers can afford these large investments in equipment and tools. Small producers basically get pushed out of business, or they get pushed into things like agritourism, you know, instead of producing food. And
Chris Bray and the other representatives and senators on the agriculture committees in Vermont made a step towards opening up things to raw milk production in Vermont earlier this year. So it'll be fun
That's
to see
wonderful.
What happens
and,
with
and
that.
Certainly Vermont is a lot better at dealing with this stuff than my state, New York, is, actually. Mm. But the reality is, across the nation, there are a lot of farmers who are essentially being pushed out of being economically viable by the fact that we take industrial agriculture as the norm.
I'm Carl Etner. You're listening to Equal Time Radio. We're talking with Sharon Astick, co-author of A Nation of Farmers, Defeating the Food Crisis on American Soil. Coming up next, we'll be speaking with Enid Wanacott. She's a director of NOFA Vermont, the Northeast Organic Farming Association. Back after this. Coming up next, we'll be talking with Enid Wanacott. She is the director of NOFA Vermont, the Northeast Organic Farming Association. Enid, welcome to Equal Time Radio.
Thanks, Carl.
So NOFA, the Northeast Organic Farming Association, does a lot more than promoting organic farming. I can see as a member who receives your mailings, I think you're focused on small-scale farming and gardening in general and a lot of the skills that you teach there. Could you tell us what you think the role of organic farming is in a stronger local food system?
Well, I think historically you've had a lot of people that are really interested in meeting their own food needs and growing for their neighbors. So you've seen a lot of small-scale producers, but, you know, over time also there's a lot of, you know, larger wholesale producers as well. So it's, you know, our role has really been to increase commercial acreage under organic production, which is now over 90,000 acres in Vermont, but also really through workshops and technical assistance support people that want to grow their own food through, you know, learning from others and being mentored, but also, you know, attending workshops. And, of course, also the infrastructure that supports those smaller markets, farmers markets and community-supported agriculture.
Right. And what do you think of this goal of having over 200,000 new farmers in Vermont?
I've always been a big small farmer fan. So, you know, and I don't know how much I didn't get to listen to your whole program and how much you've talked about movements like the Greenhorns. And
tell us about it.
Well, there's the whole really exciting beginner farmer movement happening nationally. And if you kind of Google the Greenhorns, you'll get a sense of they have a web blog that just talks about how, you know, their excitement and how they can find land and learn from each other. And they had a big gathering in Hardwick recently. 120 beginner farmers from all over the Northeast showed up to talk about access to land and to financing. And
is this the same group that put together a little book that you can download online on how to start out in farming?
Yeah.
Yeah, fascinating.
So there, you know, I encourage on so many levels about, you know, either consumers that are taking a lot of responsibility for their food system through, you know, localvore pods or transition towns that are really looking at grassroots involvement, and groups like Greenhorns that are beginner farmers that are really saying, you know, we want to do this, and how do we do it?
We'll put a link to the Greenhorns on the EqualTimeRadio.com website as well. Sharon Astick, your response?
I'm just really happy to see things like that, because I think, you know, a lot of us maybe at one point thought, you know, when you're a little kid, everybody, you ask people, little kids, what they want to grow up, and, you know, one of the choices besides, you know, train engineer and, you know,
firefighter.
Firefighter is farmer. And there are all these young people who I think naturally really see the virtues of agriculture as a way of life. And then that sort of gets, you know, shoved out of them over time. We don't value agriculture often in our cultures. You know, we say, or for example, we tell kids who are bright, oh, no, you have to go to college and get a white-collar professional job. We certainly don't always treat farmers very well in our society. And we often fail to teach our kids, yeah, that's a viable choice. That's a real option. And this surge of interest in agriculture among young people is just such an important thing, because we have a real demographic problem in agriculture. Besides all the other problems we have, the average farmer in the United States is 59 years old, and there's not another farmer coming up behind them ready to take over. So we need a lot of new farmers very soon, and they're going to be coming out of people's gardens, out of schoolyards, and out of sort of this deep passion that I think a lot of people have for land, even when maybe they haven't had a lot of opportunity to enjoy that passion, rather than the sort of traditional inherited, my dad was a farmer and my grandfather was a farmer. Well, a lot of these farmers' kids have moved away from the land, and we need new farmers coming from new places.
Well, in New England, according to the latest census data, the average age of the farmer is only 56 years. So we got 3 years on the rest of the country here. Well, Enid Wanacott, director of NOFA, Vermont Northeast Organic Farming Association, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks, Carl.
And Sharon, we just have about 20 seconds left to wrap up with your segment of the show. Can you want to say a few last words?
I mean, I guess I just really want people to get out there and try it. I mean, you can talk and talk and talk about agriculture till you turn blue, but I think the reality is we have a lot of people out there with lawns and a lot of people who say, I'd like to do it, I just don't know how. Well, there are tons of resources out there through your state, your county extension, NOFA. You don't have to be a full-time professional farmer to join NOFA. It's a great resource. And there's so many things you can do to just go out and get started and find help if you want to do it.
Sharon Astick, author of A Nation of Farmers, Defeating the Food Crisis on American Soil, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Well, 100 million farmers, that probably means that you will be much more involved in growing your own food or buying directly from your neighbors. What are you doing this week to become more food self-sufficient? I'm Carl Etnayer. That's it for Monday's Equal Time. I'll be back next Monday at 1 o'clock. The team continues tomorrow with Travin, and Wednesday through Friday, since Anthony Polina is on vacation, we'll be playing Tom Hartman in this time. Don't forget to check EqualTimeRadio.com for podcasts of the shows that Travin and I host and many links that the guests mentioned today. Artie Levine produced the show. Next week, I'll be talking with Jill Stein. She's a physician formerly at Harvard. She's now with the Massachusetts Coalition for Healthy Communities, talking about the effect of peak oil on medical care. We've got AP Network News at the top of the hour, and then Jack Donovan. Stick around for his music show. Thanks for tuning in.